Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hansen, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And today, a history episode. Victor, we are recording this on the eve of the 80th anniversary of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. This was the non-aggression treaty between Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939, which had a huge influence on the eventual shape of World War II, both because of what it allowed Hitler to accomplish in the short run as he swept through Western Europe, and then, of course, later on for how it came back to bite Stalin and the Soviets a couple years later. You wrote a column about this recently. It's also discussed a bit in your recent book, The Second World Wars. And there's a lot here. I want to start with the context around this pact. At the time, this agreement was almost incomprehensible. It sort of shocked the rest of the world. This was a thing that people thought could not happen. Why was that?
Well, because the international communist movement, the Comintern, had assured the world that the Soviet Union was the moral and legal opponent or impediment to fascism in Italy and Japan and Germany. And then suddenly, on August 23rd, 1939, it cut a deal, a non-aggression pact, that said that neither side would join in a war against each other or aid other their own allies to attack one another. And it just made everybody in the communist movement worldwide panicked, because they had bragged so much about Stalin's resistance to Hitler, and now he was a partner of Hitler. And then on the same token, British and French foreign policy had been sort of reliant on the Soviet Union, sometimes in a cynical way. They thought, you know, what's really protecting us from Hitler is not so much the democracies on the continent, Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, France, etc., but the fear of this huge Soviet Union to the rear of Germany and the memories of World War I, in which Germany fought a two-front war and exhausted itself. Once that was, that assurance was dissipated, there was just a panic throughout the Western world, as well as the communist world.
Joe Stalin is no babe in the woods. This is a man who is totally at home with cunning, with deception, with inhumanity. How is it that he so badly misreads Hitler?
Well, he wasn't so much misreading Hitler as he understood what Hitler was about, but he thought that Hitler could be massaged. In other words, once they signed that pact, he rightly expected that when he invaded Poland on the 17th of September and they carved up Poland, then Hitler would turn west. And he had remembered World War I, where there were 4 years of just awful trench warfare that had taken over 2 million casualties in France and Britain. So he was thinking that, these capitalist democracies will fight this fascist Germany, and Italy will join in, and there'll be a total bloodbath, and it will destroy both the Axis and the democracies, and then I can come in and clean up in the West, or at least I won't be threatened. And then, of course, he had grievances against Poland since the 1920s war, in which Poland did pretty well to establish its independence from the new Soviet Union. So he wanted to get territory back from Poland. He wanted Hitler to turn west. He wanted France and Britain and the continental democracies to be exhausted, and he wanted them also to weaken Germany. And then there was one other consideration that was just as important. At that time, he had been fighting a pretty bloody war along the Manchurian-Mongolian border with Japan. And Japan was sort of not doing all that well, because they were very good with air power and naval, but not so good with traditional armor and artillery, and where the Russians were pretty strong. But the Japanese had figured that the Soviet Union would never be able to bring troops across the Siberian Railroad and reinforce Marshal Zhukov, because they were worried about Germany. Suddenly, when Japan's erstwhile partner in the pact, which was the Pact of Steel, when they betrayed Japan, then Japan just collapsed and said, you know what, I'm not going to fight here anymore, and withdrew. So for Stalin, it was a win-win situation. He got rid of the Japanese war, and he got part of Poland, And then he got the assurance that Germany would waste itself destroying his enemies in the capitalist world in Western Europe.
To the point that you just made, especially as regards Japan, you say in the piece you wrote that you can draw a line from Molotov-Ribbentrop and its subsequent violation almost all the way through the war, that a tremendous amount of how World War II eventually played out owed to this agreement and what happened afterwards, including the fact that it became a global war rather than something that was limited to Europe. So explain how these decisions ended up shaping so much of what came afterwards.
Well, once they made that partnership, there was no longer any naive idealism among socialists and communists in the West. They had tried to tell these elected governments in Europe and Great Britain that the Soviet Union was a friend. And now they knew that it was not a friend. So when Hitler then thought that he had got Stalin's guard down through this year and a half of non-aggression pacts, he would eventually invade. And when he invaded, although the Allies would supply about a quarter of the military needs of the Soviet Union, they were perfectly happy for Germany and Russia to exhaust themselves on the Eastern Front in the way that Stalin had assumed would happen to them. And when Stalin kept complaining, "We want a second front, we want a second front," Churchill on more than one occasion said, "Look, when we were being bombed, you were supplying wheat and oil and coal and steel to the country that was using those materials to destroy us. And so we're going to help you, but we don't have any sympathy, and you have no position to fault us because you were an ally of our enemy." And so it kind of made the Allies cynical. But more immediately, once this pact was signed, then Hitler saw there was no impediment at all of going to war. There was no downside. So he invaded 7 days later. Poland was attacked within 3 weeks by Russia, and it was easily carved up. Hungary, Romania capitulated in the sense that their fascist governments now joined Hitler, and everybody assumed that he would turn west. And when he did turn west, he had no worries about an Eastern Front, so he could do so with three. He invaded France with nearly 2 million people, and there was nothing stopping him. And the same token, it sort of preempted. It explains the preemption at Pearl Harbor, because the Japanese army was sort of discredited now, and there was a big argument among the Japanese foreign minister and what would become the Japanese military government eventually under Tojo. And the argument was, you said that you would be successful in attacking the Soviet Union from the West with the expectation that Germany would join you and we could carve it up. But look what's happened to you. They betrayed you. And so there was a radical shift in early 1941 where the Japanese signed their own non-aggression pact. I think it was on April 13th of 1941. At that moment, two things happened. There would never be an attack on Russia from two sides. Now, Hitler at first thought that that was okay. He didn't want to share the spoils of an easy victory, but he would come to rue that very quickly and thought, my gosh, if we had not had the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, Japan might have stayed on the Manchurian border, and now we would be squeezing them. That didn't happen, but it also had a deleterious effect on Britain and the United States by turning the attention to a naval and air war. And in this case, Admiral Yamamoto said, look, in terms of tanks and trucks and artillery, you're vastly outclassed by Western powers. In terms of aircraft carriers, fighter aircraft, battleships, we have achieved parity. So we're going to shift over from fighting the Soviet Union, and we're going to fight the United States and Britain. And it's going to be easier because, in an ironic way, there is no more colonial presence by April 1941 in the Pacific. So the Japanese were eyeing the results of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and said, you know what? Colonial France doesn't exist. Colonial Denmark does not exist. Colonial Belgium does not exist. The colonial Dutch do not exist. So all of a sudden, Indonesia was wide open, and they thought French Indochina, especially Cambodia and Vietnam, rich in rice, the Dutch East Indies were rich in oil, and they looked at Britain being under the Blitz, and they thought, you know what, Singapore and Burma is open. And they only made one mistake, and that was instead of tiptoeing around Pearl Harbor and the Philippines, they got greedy and tried to get it all at once. Whereas had they just taken the oil in the Dutch East Indies and the rice in Southeast Asia and the rubber in Burma, they could have handled it without getting in a war with the United States. There was one other weird oddity about this pact, and that was for the next 4 years, you would see Liberty and Freedom ships leaving West Coast ports in Portland, Seattle, and Oakland, and they would be loaded with lend-lease materials to Russia. And when they got out in the Pacific, they would fly Russian flags, or they'd have Russian crews sometimes. And they would go right by areas where the Japanese not only controlled territorial waters, but they were fighting the Americans, and they were unharmed. So think of that, that the Japanese submarines and carriers were attacking U.S. Transport vessels in the Pacific, and yet when a Russian flag vessel went by, they had a free hand all the way to Vladivostok in the western port of Russia, so the eastern port of Russia. So it was surreal how this pact led to a lot of other quirky pacts as well.
When we're thinking of these two leaders, of Hitler and Stalin, to what degree did ideology play a role in their decision-making? I'm thinking here of your book, Carnage and Culture, where you talk about how cultural values can feed military success or failure, as the case may be. So apart from the nefariousness of their ends, are there ways in which Nazi ideology in Germany or communist ideology in the Soviet Union actually impeded their ability to effectively prosecute the war?
There was, in both cases, because they were not part of a constitutional consensual dialectic. And by that, I mean there wasn't a joint chiefs that argued with an elected Senate or had an oversight committee looking at corruption, or there wasn't a Pentagon where it was in turn funded by a legislative branch overlooked by the courts. And so there was a very small number of decision makers. And when you look at Operation Barbarossa, the idea that the Soviet Union could be invaded on a 1,600-mile front, even though it was the largest invasion in history, 3.5 million people, but the Soviet Union was so vast, and there were no German reserves, and there had been voices of dissent. General Guderian had said, you know, they have something called the T-34 tank that's better than anything that we have and anything that we have on the drawing boards. And he was dismissed as sort of a whiner and an alarmist. And so there was, and by the same token, people had gone to Stalin and said, Richard Sorge, our plant in the Tokyo embassy, has outlined this whole invasion. And we know what Hitler's doing. He's going to invade us along this huge European front. And Stalin had people shot because he thought that they were agents from Britain or the United States trying to stir up a civil war, but what he would call an internecine war between two authoritarian powers. And then more importantly, they sort of mirror image themselves because they were not only both suspicious of one another, but they both employed the same means. And by that I mean Hitler was once asked, what would he do with Stalin if he won? And he said, well, I'd give him a nice retirement dock under lock and key, but when I get a hold of Roosevelt and Churchill, I'll hang both of them, because Stalin is a genius. He was not afraid to, you know, kill 20 million people. So they had a very sick admiration for one another, because they were, although their ideologies were dissimilar, their methodologies were almost identical.
So the final question that I'll put to you, World War II occupies a fundamentally different place in the American psyche than other modern wars. It's still valorized in popular culture. It's really the only war within living memory that is almost always thought of as a source of national pride. And a lot of that probably owes to the extremity of the war, how sharp the moral contrast was between the combatants, how dramatic the stakes were, the Holocaust, how implausible any of the alternatives to war really seemed. But most wars don't come quite to that level of clarity. I mean, if you think of almost everything that followed, Korea, Vietnam, the first Gulf War was maybe a little less ambiguous, but it almost kind of seems forgotten now, Afghanistan, Iraq. So my question for you, is it a mistake for Americans to judge the value of a war by how it compares to World War II, given that it was such an outlier? Is that setting the bar too high, or is that sort of precisely why it's valuable?
Well, it's a war that played uniquely to American strengths of industrial production, firepower, logistics, and there were no restraints on it. Once we were attacked, then we've had the moral high ground. Hitler declared war against us. We didn't declare war against Hitler. Same is true against Mussolini. So we had moral clarity, as you point out, but then there was no idea that anybody had nuclear weapons except eventually us. And there was going to be, this was a nation that was butchering thousands and tens of thousands and millions of people that were innocent civilians. Of the 65 million dead in World War II, 70% of them were civilians. So the same was true of Japan, that was butchering 15 million in China. So the American public thought, we were attacked, there are no restraints on our response, and our response, even if it turns out to be quite punitive and quite deadly, is going to be a moral act because it's going to prevent these awful regimes from killing more people. So the more Germans and Japanese that we kill, the more innocents live. And that was unique because we've never had a war before where the United States was attacked first, and then second, where there was no nuclear restraint on the logical expression of American firepower. And then three, this isn't a war to be fought in the jungles of Vietnam or right along the Chinese border in Korea or out in Afghanistan. It was a conventional war where we had easily supplied areas in North Africa or the Solomons or the Philippines or Europe, and we could use conventional firepower. So it wasn't a war where, you know, as we saw in Iraq, or as what Donald Trump said the other day about Afghanistan, I could blow the thing up and kill 10 million people. But we can't do that. So then we fight these wars on the terms of our enemies, and that usually means it's asymmetrical and involves civilians and press coverage and the entire mess that we've seen in the last 75 years after World War II.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.